Hello and welcome to another episode of the Zeitgeist Tapes. I'm political journalist Emma Burnell and I'm joined as always by Professor Emeritus Stephen Fielding. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Emma. Hello, listener.
So we have a Zeitgeist Tapes first this month. We're actually going to do a double bill. This is because I came to Steve and said, do you think we should do Mr. Smith Goes to Washington? And Steve said, well, actually what we should do is meet John Doe. And so we said, well, why don't we watch both of them? Because as you rightly said, they clearly inform each other. And these are both films from the 1930s by Frank Capra. Steve, why is Frank Capra still politically relevant?
Well, I think he's as relevant now as he was at the peak of his sort of directorial sort of apogee, if that's not too ridiculous a word. Because by the time, I mean, Frank Capra was a first generation Italian immigrant, settled in with very, very young with his parents in California, and became probably the most successful in terms of popular audience directors of the 1930s and the early 1940s. And by the time these two films were made, the first, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington in 1939, and the second, Meet John Doe, 1941, he could basically make any kind of film that he wanted. He had that kind of a power. And he made his name in comedy, and
yeah, he made screwball comedies, didn't he?
Screwball comedies, yes. And It Happened One Night still holds up. I saw it recently. It really is a very good and very funny film. Clark Gable and that film actor whose name I can't remember. So I think so. He was relevant. He was politically relevant in the late 30s, early 40s, because these two films discuss populism. And he was often, many of his early films were very kind of like pro the people. Everyone's great. I mean, that's kind of like pandering to the audience. But he became more political because he became more aware of the threats to American democracy, and kind of opened out the possibilities of saving American democracy. He outlined the threats as he saw them, and he outlined how you could save American democracy. Now, the reason why I think, talking about this long forgotten director, who's probably now more famous for It's a Wonderful Life, that Christmas weepy, which has similar themes to these two films to some extent. The
and
reason
in
why,
one case, the same the same star.
Well, had the same start. I mean, he had a kind of like a coterie. He had a little company of actors that he used again and again, often in similar roles. But he's now, I think, even he's as relevant as he was at his peak, because what's, you know, Donald Trump and American populism is obviously right here and right now. And some of the things that Capra has to say about populism, I think, shed a light on what's happened in American politics. Bearing in mind, I should have mentioned right at the start, Frank Capra was a Republican. He was quite explicit in that. He was no Hollywood lefty. So I thought it'd be quite interesting to sort of look at these two films, particularly as they share so many of the themes, of the same themes, and in some cases, the same actor plays the villain, Edward Arnold. He is the villain in both films.
Yes.
The female protagonists are very, very similar. They even share the same backstory in both films. The male protagonist is very, very similar, sort of an outsider, innocent, coming in. And in the case of Mr. Smith, possibly the more famous of the two, well, definitely the more famous of the two, coming in sort of on the back of a dead senator. He's appointed because the people that are appointing him think he's going to be a bit of a patsy. They can do what they want with him. And he discovers, having been an idealist, an idealist in the possibilities of American democracy, he finds the corruption. And we sort of take that journey about how does he react to his ideals being traduced by reality. And the other sort of outsider character, Meet John Doe, is a kind of transient baseball player who had an injury. So that explains why he's sort of going around the country, and he's taken up and is produced as being a kind of there's a made up character that he fits the bill and he's made to play a part, which it's trying to try, express the idealism of the possibility of changing politics. And he's kind of, in the end, he believes in these ideals, but then there's a threat to those ideals, and we have to, again, he goes on a journey in the same way that Jefferson Smith does in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. So I think there's a lot of things in there that our listener might be interested in. And I'm actually interested in what you might think, Emma, because I used to teach these films. I mean, I know Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I can always do it by heart now, because I'm showing clips to the students for so many years. And I just thought there were sort of areas of that these two films share, like in terms of populism and what Capra, how it presents it, the threats of it, the possibilities of it, the role of the media in manipulating how people might feel about politics. I think the interest, and also the interesting role of the two female protagonists, given that these films are from the late 30s, early 1940s, and then maybe think, well, what does it say about American populism today, and our own kind of populism today?
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to question you a little bit as a political historian about something that you said there. In terms of he was a Republican, so he was no Hollywood lefty. Because I would say that the Republicans of the 1930s and 40s were quite different from the Republican, what the Republican Party later became. And in many ways, a 1930s Republican espousing exactly what a 1930s Republican believed then would be considered almost far left now, wouldn't they?
Well, certainly there'd be some elements of that, but the Republic, I mean, the isolationism was certainly in there in America amongst Republicans of that time. And you have to sort of also remember that FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, had been president since 1932, and had introduced, the New Deal in a big state. And there are some, if you sort of watched it more carefully, there are little snide things in both films about government spending that might reflect some more traditional Republican tropes. Clearly, the Republican Party over the last 10 to 20 years has had a remarkable transformation into the party of Trump, essentially. So yeah, we have to historicize it a little bit. But you also have to note that the Democrats were doing things in the 1930s and 40s that would, I mean, they'd be shot as communists, right, in America today.
Shot as communists on sort of economic policy, but also the Southern Democrats were, a big issue in terms of the social progress, particularly around race. And there wasn't a huge racial storyline in either of these films, but there were moments where you just notice. So there's a point in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington where a bunch of boys, one of the sort of subplots is all about boys' clubs and getting kids out of inner city areas into nature and discovering the American wilderness kind of thing. And though that was a mixed group of boys, and there were shots that were quite clearly making a point of, look, here's a little black boy doing stuff that the little white boy is also doing.
Yes. Yeah. It was kind of. It was a predominantly white film, as you might expect. Hollywood of that time. But yeah, Mr. Smith. That one. I think it was just the one black boy. He even gets some lines to speak. I think that's kind of deliberate. That must be
Yeah, it
deliberate.
felt deliberate.
Yes.
And when Mrs. Smith makes his sort of final peroration, he says, everyone's the same, no matter of race, creed, or colour or race. So yeah, there's a real kind of, this is the, when we say every man, we mean every man. Every woman, possibly less so. There are, as you say, these very strong female protagonist roles, but they are always in support of the man out front.
Well, again, you would expect that from Hollywood of this era.
Yes.
I mean, why don't we talk about the female characters first then? Because I mean, there's a point in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington where he talks to Saunders, who plays a really significant role in this in terms of not only helping him identify the problem of corruption, but giving him the ability and the knowledge to actually confront it and ultimately kind of defeat it. And in Meet John Doe, actually the character of John Doe is created by the female character, just as she's been sacked as there's new ownership of the paper she's on, and she's told, "Oh, you're just too violets and old lace and everything." And she creates this character as a kind of last thing that she writes, and then is the guide for the guy calls who assumes the mantle of John Doe, and he becomes her character. But there's a moment in Mr. Smith where Mr. Smith goes to Saunders, who's the secretary, his secretary, who's been in Washington for a very long time and is very disillusioned. He says, "You've done really well for a woman."
And it is the sort of classic old school trope of behind every great man there's a great woman. And I think for some you would focus on the word great, but for others it's the behind that is the complicating factor there. And both of them, of course, because this is a film, they're not just allowed to be female characters who do the work that they do to drive the storyline. They also have to fall in love with the protagonist.
I mean, Capra retained sort of the more conventional sort of elements of a popular film. He wanted to make popular films. They weren't just films about populism that were meant to affect the audience. I mean, there's a lot of stuff about what the individual can do. You might think the individual could do nothing in terms of changing politics. Well, you'd be wrong. And in many ways, the two films are about trying to get the individual member of the audience to get a sense of their own agency. But yeah, I mean, he uses the sort of architecture of conventional sort of popular films. But these two characters, don't you think? I mean, today you'd go, well, so she's a secretary, but she's more than a secretary, really, in terms of helping Mr. Smith. And the Barbara Stanwyck character in Meet John Doe, she's a journalist. I mean, you think, well, that's fair enough today, but then. They're professional women who've got independent identities, and as I've said, without them giving the two male characters guidance, they wouldn't have really got very far.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm not, I don't wish to take anything away from either of the characters or the performances. I'm just, slightly looking at it through my 2024 radical feminist
Sure.
lens, which is, what this podcast, I suppose, is all about. Not my radical feminist lens, but the interpretation of political works through the ages in terms of modern politics. But I ultimately, while these were interesting subplots, the role of women wasn't the core story. It's the
No.
role of the populace, and the and particular, I think, both of them are driven by the intertwining of a corrupt media and a corrupt politics.
Yes. Yeah, that's also really kind of very relevant, obviously, to today. I mean, when Mr. Smith, because if anyone knows anything about Mr. Smith, it's usually the filibuster, the
Yeah,
filibuster.
of course.
And not many people know why he was doing that, but they know that he did a filibuster. And Mr. Smith does his filibuster because he's discovered the corruption. There's a corrupt land deal going through the Senate, and with it within and it's the big boss who basically controls the state from which he comes. I mean, he's a capitalist. He owns all the newspapers, it appears. He has lots of fingers in the pies of the radio station. So basically controls the media of the day in the state. And he's got all the senators in his pocket, apart from Mr. Smith, but he thought he did. And it seems all the congressmen as well. That he wants to expose this, having been accused of corruption himself. And in order
Well, he's
to
accused of corruption, isn't he? Because he is threatening to expose it.
his because he's threatening to expose it. So thanks to Saunders, he discovers this filibuster device, and he hopes that by standing up in the Senate and outlining the nature of the corruption, that will get to the people back home. And he explicitly thinks it's going to get reported, and then they'll all rise up against this corruption. And it doesn't, and they don't, because Jim Taylor, the Jim Taylor who owns everything, the media magnate and big capitalist, he owns the media. So the only message that gets through to the people in the States is the one that Smith is corrupt. He's the one that's stopping, this legislation going through that otherwise would help people. And he is the one who's being attacked, and his whole kind of persona is being reversed. He's the corrupt one, and in the end, that message never gets through. The message he wants never gets through because of the power of the media. And you meet John Doe. Like I say, the character is made up. He's not a real person, but he's projected as being a real person, and he becomes the kind of the voice of people's frustration with politics. And it becomes very, very popular. There are these John Doe clubs that are formed and financed by, again, played by Edward Arnold, the big capitalist. But initially we think, oh, he's just a good guy. But in the end, it turns out he wants to use the character of John Doe to help him run for to become president, and then impose this authoritarian regime upon the American people. So the role of the media in shaping how people think about politics is kind of really central to both films.
Absolutely. And yeah, they are in many ways films about messaging. Films about narrative, obviously something that that's what I do for a living. So it's something I'm fascinated by, and the power of the megaphone and whether that power can be undermined by a competing but truer narrative. I think the other sort of really core message in these, and we're obviously talking about a decade where coming out of the Great Depression, lots and lots of very poor people who felt very we weren't they weren't still in the Depression, but they were only just out of it. The insecurity, which probably also speaks to the idea that government wastes lots of money and is doing lots of spending. But what I found fascinating is that we constantly hark back in this day and age to a time when we were better communities, a time when you talk to your neighbour. And one of the pivotal scenes in Meet John Doe is when, the baseball player, who's not called John Doe, is sort of saying, "Look, I'm not, this isn't me. I feel uncomfortable. I'm pretending to be something I'm not." And a bunch of people who have formed the John Doe Club come in and say, "We never used to talk to our neighbors, and we didn't do," and they have this very idealized version where they do then, having heard him make a speech about talking to your neighbor, they come up and tell him this story about how they'd held a public meeting in all of it starts with one guy talking to his cranky neighbor, who he thought was just rude, and it turns out he was just deaf. And then the family in the big house who they all think are doing so well and are too snobby to talk to them, but actually they're not doing well and they've been selling off all the furniture and they're too ashamed to talk to them. And everyone comes together in this community. And I found it fascinating that that narrative of we don't talk to our neighbor anymore. Again, one of the lines in that final bit of the filibuster is that the fundamental rule is Love Thy Neighbour. So
Yes.
this is definitely a big theme of Frank Capra that we've forgotten to be parts of communities. And, plus ça change, right? Because that's again one of the big populist narratives is that we're not talking to each other in communities. We are, you've got your out of touch metropolitan liberal elite who don't talk to the real folk. And actually, it's those real folks where communities reside. Now, the politics of that narrative have flipped, or not, because they're both being driven by, as you say, the right in terms of the Republican Party. But it is that still that same powerful small communities of little guys versus the big machine of the elites.
Yeah, just happens to be a very different kind of conception of the elite, which for a Republican, he's got quite some criticisms or implicit criticisms of big business, little people and little business he likes. But no, you're right. I mean, the idea that I mean, if you sort of break down, well, what does Frank Capra's populism really consist of? I mean, in both films, it's ultimately being a good neighbor to each other. There is some kind of vague Christianity thing going on as well, like you were quoting from, Love Thy Neighbor. And also, he was a Catholic. He was an Italian Catholic. I mean, there's some both of the main male characters, there's elements where they're often referred to as a bit like Christ. So there's something like that going on. But there's also an element that I think is indisputable about the role of American patriotism, the American Constitution, the great men. Lincoln pops up quite a bit. I mean, he plays a big role. I mean, Mr. Smith goes to
Yes,
Washington
absolutely.
twice, and he gets ultimate inspiration to take on the corruption from the Lincoln Memorial when and Saunders actually says he's been waiting for someone like you to kind of live up to the ideals of the refounding of the Union and going back to Washington and all that kind of stuff. It's a very patriotic kind of populism and a very kind of traditional one of, nowadays, of course, woke history, dread phrase. We all know what, George Washington was a slave owner, Jefferson, blah, 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 all of that. But these are heroes in these films. These are heroes. They're the, I think in Meet John Doe, the cynical journalist editor who becomes, who reveals after getting drunk, he's an idealist. These are the lights. These are the lights of the world. These people. So there's a, and when Mr. Smith goes around, I mean, and he's when he first goes to Washington, he goes, oh, there's the Capitol Dome. Oh my God, he's read about these things, and he goes off on a tourist tour, and we go on a tourist tour for about 5 minutes with Yankee Doodle Dandy and all the other things taken. American history and ending with We the People and all that jazz, right? And which actually always affects me. I'm not American.
No, but absolutely.
I know America has done some very bad things, but there are things within, the founding of the American Constitution and what happened, abolishing slavery and all that kind of stuff, which are truly, as far as I'm concerned, truly inspiring, no matter there's a dark side to all of that too. And there's that there, he's an American, this is populism. We're patriots, we're the people. But it's all very, very positive as well. It's not anti-immigrant, like we've both noted. There was an attempt to include sort of the black population within all of this, within the limits that Hollywood sort of, found itself within at that point. So yeah, it's sort of interesting the way in which that was a kind of more progressive with a small p. Kind of populism. It
Absolutely.
wasn't the kind of populism that Donald Trump, funnily enough, mentioning him, articulated.
No, and I think that's the key difference, isn't it? There's a populism and a patriotism of optimism, and there's a
Yeah.
populism and a patriotism of fear. And I think that's the nugget of what Capra was showing in the in his sort of unpacking of the good and bad of populism. And I think, he's like, pro the optimistic and anti the power of fear, and the power of hate. But the not to add a third variable to our double bill, but I actually went to see Hamilton again on Friday, which again is, that really optimistic telling of the founding of the American story and the American Constitution and the Federalist Papers and all of that. I do often slightly smile wryly at the fact that the second half of the musical is very much about the setting up of the American financial system, and yet this is a musical so coded left wing that then you're like, really? It's actually about finance capitalism, but okay. But again, it that ideal that the founding fathers represent is something that the liberal left can and should embrace as a form of patriotism and populism, patriotism for Americans, populism, I guess, for us. But patriotism has become, at least, I don't know if it always was, a very contested value on the left. And I think that's, I mean, I understand that patriotism and populism have been wildly abused, but I also don't think you're going to stop people being patriotic. So it's how you work within that framework of, yes, absolutely, I love my country. That's why I want it to be better than it is. And I think the left narrative and that was prevalent in Hamilton is that the unfinished project is what a leftist patriotism can tap into. Whereas the right wing patriotism and populism is more a harking back to, and a sense that we've moved away from the project.
Yeah, I mean, and but Capra, I mean, being a Republican, being first generation immigrant, he was in love with America. He was in love with the idea of America. And so, I mean, if you watch it now, the idealism of those characters and all of that you'd always get people, particularly on the left, tutting and rolling their eyes and going, "Oh, it wasn't like that." Well, that's all very well and good, but if you're living in a particular country, you use the material in that country, and you don't get very far by rubbishing it, without being, So Capra's coming for at a time when you could be, not that he was on the left, although, relatively, as we've already suggested, he's probably very left wing for today. But it was a time when you could be on the left and be patriotic. And obviously, there may be some troubles with that. Labour Party was not too bad, not exactly totally against the empire at this point. But you could be patriotic and link being patriotic to your political project, which, at this point in time in both countries was pretty bloody radical, certainly when compared to today. But I wondered also, because about Capra's populism, because some people might say, well, it's all very well and good, it's just two bloody films. So what happened after? But Capra did sort of, the films were kind of meant to get the audiences thinking, whether they thought in the way that Capra wanted them to, I don't know. But it was about ultimately saying, look, these two guys have taken on all, they had their doubts, they wondered. I mean, at one, well, towards the end of Meet John Doe, the final bit is him deciding to kill himself. In order to try to prove to people that he truly believed in the ideals that he was articulating, for a while, and he really believes in them, as a way of trying to get people to get back to that, and to see that he was authentic, even though he wasn't authentic, and that might then get the John Doe movement going again. And Mr. Smith collapses, and they think he's dead for a certain point towards the end of the filibuster. That these guys have had it hard, but in the end, they prevail, or at least they might prevail at the end of Meet John Doe. We're not quite sure. But to get the audience to think, you can change this system. The system which you see is sort of distant, corrupt, and the films themselves outline in quite pessimistic terms. The politicians seem to be, a lot of the politicians are corrupt. Big business runs politics. It controls the media, and it's very nip and tuck that the two heroes prevail. I mean, it's they're not totally goo-eyed and optimistic. They do show that the problems of anyone that change the system. And ironically, of course, at least as I see it, Norton, who's the big bad villain in Meet John Doe, those that it's the villains that look more like Trump, the inauthentic populists, the ones that are trying to exploit it for their own authoritarian purposes, which you think, Jesus, they could be Donald Trump. So from my viewing, anyway, of them.
Absolutely, 100%. Big media players, big business, probably more successfully than Trump, who has gone bankrupt several times. There isn't the moral. Well, there's a little bit of that. There's a bit in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington where the main baddie is having a party and he comes in with a diamond necklace. And says, who wants this? And a group gaggle of women sort of throw themselves at him to get the necklace. And that sort of struck me as both the sexual morality of Donald Trump, but also the apprentice star, which one of you is going to get my apprenticeship? Coming back to the ending. Can we just take a moment to recognize the genius that is Claude Rains?
Yes, we can. Yes, please do.
So, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, one of the most interesting characters is the corrupt senator, who is called, you'll have to remind me,
Pain.
Payne, that's it.
Yes.
And in the, one of the things that Jefferson Smith is accused of by the press in his state is traducing Paine, who has always had this reputation as an absolute, white knight,
Yes.
really seen as an idealistic senator, but actually when he got there fairly soon, he was put into the pocket of the big bad guy. And made the compromise, and he talks about that he had to compromise in order to get some of the things he wanted done. He
Yeah.
had to be
Great scene.
and this character is played by Claude Rains, and I was slightly confused because obviously Claude Rains is also Louis in Casablanca, which was 2 years later, and he looks 20 years younger.
Well, he's got a white wig on, that's why. It's the
I mean,
wig.
it is just the wig, but it's also he's chubbier.
Well,
He's also he's like Marlon Brando method before Marlon Brando had even thought of it.
yeah, it was the wig. It was mostly the wig, though, to be fair.
But what Claude Rains does with that character and with the character of Louis in Casablanca is really cleverly demonstrate that internal struggle between of the character who doesn't want to pick a side, who is really struggling to just find the glide path through, but actually at his heart wants to eventually do the right thing. And in both Casablanca and Mrs. Smith Goes to Washington, the actual denouement of the at the end of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Mr. Smith has been passed out on the floor for about 4 or 5 minutes of the end of the film. And it is Claude Rains's character, Senator Payne, who cannot take it anymore. And rushes from the chamber, starts smashing things up, and is brought back into the chamber and says, Don't expel Mr. Smith. Expel me. I'm the one. It was all me. I did it all.
Yes.
And I was sitting there watching this, thinking, Louis, this could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Well, yeah, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. I think I'm not entirely sure Louis was ever the, because the thing about the Payne character is, I mean, he starts off in his backstory is that he worked with Jefferson Smith's father. He was a crusading lawyer. His father, Jefferson Smith, was a crusading journalist. They took on the mine owners, and Jefferson Smith's father was shot dead, right? And from that point, we understand, again, because it's a great scene when Payne and Smith, basically, Smith says, you've betrayed all this idealism, you're corrupt. And then he explains, as you say, well, I had to compromise. And as a compromise, it's a man's world, Jeff. It's a man's world. And you should go away, go away, go back to the wilderness and your ideals. And he makes a point. He makes an argument for compromise. Yeah, you've got to do this to get some good. And he points out what good he's done. But he clearly loses himself. He clearly loses himself. And it's Jefferson Smith's exposure of the corruption and his stand, against all the odds in the filibuster, which in the end. I mean, he's not, you can see it in his eyes. I mean, Claude Rains' acting is really good because you can see it in the eyes. He's feeling very uneasy about the exposure of Smith as a corrupt character, and eventually
And
he
yet
sees
he leads
his
the
error.
charge on the Senate floor.
He does because he feels that he has to, but he's clearly in conflict. And in the end, Jefferson Smith's filibuster just gets to him, and he tries. It's the most unsuccessful suicide bid I have seen. He's got a revolver in his hand. You've already heard two gunshots, and yet he's missed. Right. Anyway, but yes, you're absolutely right. He comes back. Jefferson Smith is defeated because because they bring in all these the voice of the people is brought into the Senate floor in the shape of all these telegrams, which have all been shaped by the Taylor machine manipulating how people think back in the state. And they're all saying, "Stop Jefferson Smith, you're corrupt, blah, blah, blah." Jefferson Smith is defeated. It's Payne finally seeing the light. And I think because Capra's bring both films, politicians, established politicians, don't. I mean, it's very anti-politics in many ways. I mean, politicians aren't allowed to join the John Doe clubs.
Absolutely, yeah.
But there that there is some possibility that even a corrupted politician can see the error of their ways. So the system might be salvageable. But you're absolutely right. I'm glad you mentioned it because Payne is the most interesting character in that film, and it's largely thanks to Claude Rains, I think, who is, I mean, he was a Gene Hackman of his generation. Whenever he was in a film, that was that. The, that but it could have been a rubbish film, but when he was in that scene, they were good scenes.
Yeah, my uncle used to say that about John Cusack and Terry Garr. You might
Right.
not always get a 5-star film, but you'll never get anything less than a 3.
Yes.
And you're right, that's Gene Hackman, that is Claude Rains. And yeah, I did find the comparison with Louis from Casablanca, which is obviously a film I just know backwards. Like,
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
in the way that Mrs. Smith Goes to Washington, I know Casablanca, although I've never taught it because, thankfully, to all concerned, I'm not a teacher.
Yes.
But yeah, the character's internal struggle and the way that Rains portrays that, and you kind of see it throughout the film, and it's quite interesting because well before he accuses Smith of being the corruption of all the things of which he's guilty, he
Yes.
basically just lays that charge sheet at Smith's door, and has loads of people make up stuff about Smith, including someone who Smith was clearly close to because it was the owner of the land. Which was a slightly underexplored bit because you never got what his motivation was, so I assume he was
No,
paid.
no, no. Yeah, it's a bit underwritten that, but time goes on. You have to.
Indeed. And it was quite a long film for the day anyway.
Yes.
But there's a point with the party that I referred to earlier with the diamond necklace. He's sat there looking at that spectacle, being utterly disgusted by it. And yet he goes on to do this, the accusations of corruption. And he's what you know, you see his face in the Senate. And he's clearly uncomfortable. And yet, at any given moment where he has the opportunity, up until that very, very end, he goes in hard on Mr. Smith.
Yes, but he did try to keep him away. I mean, he didn't do that with any enthusiasm. He tried to find other ways of getting Jeff to get off the trail a bit.
Yeah, up
But
to and including using his awful daughter.
well, there we can go on a thing, but maybe with we haven't got the time for it, about how a certain kind of woman is presented. The hyper glam woman, the kind of woman that Donald Trump really only seems to include in his coterie.
Yeah.
They're the ones that they're part of the corruption of Washington. But anyway, have you got anything else to say? I mean, I think wonder if we've prevailed on the time of our listener.
We have slightly. The only last thing I would say is that the last theme of Capra, that not less political, but does have an element of it, is the father figure, the patriarch, which
Yes.
I would say in Mr. Smith is the president of the Senate.
He's the vice president. Yes, the vice
The
president. Yeah,
vice president
the benign vice president. Yeah.
who enforces the rules fairly. And
Yes.
clearly, you see quite a lot of him smiling indulgently
Yes.
at
Yeah.
Jefferson Smith. There clearly to be that sort of rules enforcing, firm but fair patriarchal character, which I think probably because he didn't have an awful lot of backstory, I think that he was there to represent the good of the system, the good of the
Oh yeah,
Senate.
yes, yeah. I mean, he was played by if audiences would have known who he was, so an actor called Harry Carey, who was a very big cowboy star.
Right, what a white hat.
So, yes, oh, definitely a white hat. Yes. So, and that kind of does reinforce another very big difference between Capra's populism, patriotic populism, and what has gone, is now amongst us. It's rule based. It's
Absolutely. He
about
does
going
not
to the
want to overthrow the
Constitution.
system. He believes the system, it could be great.
Yes.
Make the system great again.
Yes, make the system great again. Absolutely. Go back to Washington and all those people and Lincoln, and yeah, what's more rules based than having a filibuster?
Absolutely, exactly.
Yeah.
A final note for our listeners. Steve and I both initially ordered Meet John Doe on Amazon Prime. Listeners, do not do this. A, it's free on Netflix, and B, the version on Netflix
Is
is
it YouTube?
clean and clear
YouTube.
and crisp. YouTube, sorry, is
Yes.
clean and clear and crisp. The version on Amazon Prime is one of the worst prints I've ever seen, and I got my money back
As
for it.
did I, to be fair to Amazon. But yes, don't go to Amazon for that. But the print of Mr. Smith, because it's been preserved, and it's
By the
all,
Library of Congress.
and yeah, with the help of the BFI and all that kind of stuff. And it's lovely, but yeah, avoid that John Doe. But meet John Doe on YouTube.
Meet John Doe on YouTube and
Yes.
Mrs. Smith Goes to Washington, available in all sorts of places.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your time again, Steve. It's always a brilliant conversation. Where can people keep up with you?
Well, if they really, really want to, I'm on Blue Sky. But I forgot my profile name. You took me by surprise.
Are you Pol Prof Steve there as well?
Something like that, yeah. Just Google me, and you'll but my name. And if you really want, I mean, I doubt very much anybody would want to. But if you really want to, just Google my name, and all kinds of things pops up. I'm not the horror writer that was in a goth band, by the way. I'm not that Stephen Fielding.
That's a shame. I feel that I can picture you in a goth band, and that's quite an enjoyable image.
Yes.
I am Emma Burnell on Blue Sky. You can also read my newsletter, The Political Human, and you can come and see my play, Four
Oh.
Weigh-ins and a Funeral, which is appearing in the Lion and Unicorn Theatre in Kentish Town in London between the 6th and 10th of May.
Right.
But before you do any of those things, please, if you have enjoyed this, please rate and review us on iTunes. It does help to raise the profile of the podcast, which will bring us more listeners, which we think it we deserve. So thank you to Lord Stewart Wood of Anfield for our music, and this has been a Political Human production.